Hi, this is Joe Patty. Thanks for listening to WRTI Online. This service is made possible through the support of WRTI's members. You can become a member, too. Since you're already online, just visit www.wrti.org and click the Become a Member link on the upper left corner of the webpage. You can also join us by phone at 1-866-809-9784. Your membership will help keep WRTI's broadcast and online services strong. And again, thank you. Now, on with the show.
Well, I'm going to welcome David Kim here, one of the finest artists that we have, I guess, in the world today, basically. He's got one of the plum positions with one of the top orchestras in the world. Again, Philadelphia always has had one. And David, I think we're going to talk a little bit about you and your choice to become a member of an orchestra. First of all, you had dreams, I think, when you were younger of being a soloist. Is that right?
That's right. My destiny was set by my mother before I was even born. And she wanted to have a son and have that son become a world-class violinist. And so this was what the only thing I knew at the expense of everything else in life, schoolwork, chores around the house. It was a completely one-track existence.
But how did you feel about it? I mean, sometimes children are drawn to instruments and they kind of want to do it, you know. But did you feel that you were forced to do it? Or?
Yes.
Yes, you did. Well, actually, it's not really that funny. I think it probably was a chore. And did you feel that you had a facility for it?
Well, you know, my mother was so determined that she, you know, a lot of parents say things like, well, we're going to wait and see whether little Johnny has a good ear or whether he has some drive or all this. My mother, honestly, did not care whether I didn't have the drive, didn't care whether I had perfect pitch or not. She just believed that all of this was basically predestined, and all we had to do was just water it and give it sunlight, and it would grow into a concert violinist. And so there was never a moment where she and my father would sit down and say, well, do you think he's right for this, or this is the life for him? It was absolutely, from the age of three, what I was supposed to do. And so the intensity at which she made me practice was so difficult that I must admit to you, I did not like it. And there were moments where I might have enjoyed a little bit performing, maybe, but the actual day-to-day existence was unpleasant. I'm very grateful now. I have two daughters. One is here today, Natalie. She's six, and she started playing the violin when she was not even three. And then our daughter Maggie is six. Obviously, my wife and I don't push our children to play, but thankfully, they do enjoy practicing, so we don't have to fight every day. And I do remember most days of my childhood crying with frustration, anger, because I just didn't like it. And my mother practiced with me. And so we would fight and argue, and it was very intense.
I mean, it's really quite a fantastic story that you ultimately grew up, and you took hold of this thing that really was a cause of difficulty and unhappiness in your life. I mean, a lot of children would have said, you know, that's it. I'm not going to do it. You know, I can't go on this way. This is not my life. This is my life. It's not your life. So for you to embrace it and to continue on, and not only to continue on, but to be so successful at it, is really an achievement, I think, just on your part. You must have had some kind of strength in your heart, or you may have even loved it and you didn't know it.
This has become like a
Well, that's exactly what
analysis here. I'm like, I guess so. But no, I think you're right, Jill. There were moments when I did enjoy it. I think it was not so much about the music for me as a small child. And even at the age of, say, my daughter Natalie, I don't think I enjoyed the music as much. But there were moments where I enjoyed the sheer athleticism, because my teacher really nurtured the technical aspects of my playing early on. She just felt that you just had to drill it in early, and then later on the music would come. And I would like to think that part of my facility is just from that those sheer hours. And so there were some moments where I kind of reveled in that kind of facility that was there early on.
Well, again, but there was another decision that you made later on. You actually were thinking, or your mother was thinking, of you becoming a soloist. Wasn't that the plan? I mean, did you?
Totally.
You weren't going to become an orchestral musician. Not that it's any less, but it's a totally different path. So when were you the one that came to terms with the reality that you really not only didn't want to be a soloist, or perhaps you didn't feel that you had it to become a soloist? I think you were honest with yourself and you faced certain things, or was this just a decision?
Well, I basically had an epiphany when I was in my 30s, and hindsight is 20/20, but I did realize at that point that I did not have what it took to become one of these great soloists. But I just wish I had had that epiphany about 10 years earlier. But it was just something that came about. It's in this movie, Music from the Inside Out, I've spoken of it. Mm-hmm. But it really came about strangely, probably not just from seeing this movie, but I saw this movie called Jerry Maguire, which was kind of a similar trajectory about
sports,
but reaching almost the top level, the A level, and then kind of not making it, and then falling all the way down, and then redemption. And I found that movie resonated with me, and then it kind of overnight I decided, you know what, this is just not going to happen. I'm 34 years old, and there are all these like 18 and 19-year-old kids playing with the Philadelphia Orchestra, and I'm not. And just all these things kind of came about, and just I understood that, you know what, I got to be a man. I got to be the man of the house. I got to go out and make a living.
The meditation from Thais by Jules Massenet, performed by David Kim, violinist, with Gail Niwa at the piano.
My mother, unfortunately, passed away when I was 14, and many times, I've been in this orchestra for 10 years now. I've performed all over the world. It is truly the most incredible life to be able to go and play in Carnegie Hall and play in Paris and Vienna and Tokyo and to stand up and play a concerto and to do something like this, Jill, to talk with you. It's amazing. And I think to myself,
he's very politically correct.
No, I'm serious. And I think to myself, I wish my mother had lived so I could hopefully see her, the satisfaction in her eyes when she would see how wonderful a life I'm leading now, even though I'm not an Itzhak Perlman or a Yo-Yo Ma or anything. But the fact that I'm...
Well, speaking of Itzhak Perlman, I interviewed him actually this week, and he's playing today, and that's why I'm here, and he's there, and David is here.
And all these people are here.
But Itzhak Perlman did say something about you. I mean, I think, weren't you on a show or something together? And he had pointed out, how old were you, 13 at the time?
Oh, younger than that. I was about 11 or 11. 10.
As one of the great child prodigies, I think he was saying. Wasn't he saying you had a future?
He's very kind. It was a show called Child Prodigy, and they put several of us, well, three of us actually, at different stages of our musical careers. I was there as a prodigy, and then there was an 18-year-old girl who had been an incredible child prodigy and was enjoying a great career at that point, and then Mr. Perlman, who had made it. And sadly, the 18-year-old girl went on and had a nervous breakdown, and now she's living in Long Island and doesn't even play the violin anymore.
You know, it's funny, we did discuss this on the interview. Any of you who have heard Crossover, that was on yesterday. And Perlman was talking about the fact that just because you don't make it, maybe to be a soloist, you still, if you love music and you want to make a career out of music, you choose other things. It doesn't mean that you don't have that you have to throw it away. Now, what has happened to David is he has made a decision, of course, and you have achieved this wonderful position of concertmaster of one of the great orchestras. That's a whole different ballgame, I think, because being a concertmaster, I don't think a lot of you know what a concertmaster is. And David, perhaps you can talk about the responsibility that a concertmaster has. I mean, he's sitting in the first chair, and I guess he instructs the strings how to play into the bow markings and so on. But there's a great deal more, and perhaps you can tell everybody about that.
Well, it's kind of a mysterious position. You kind of straddle this line between management and labor. And you're kind of a leader of the orchestra, and yet you must remain humble, because as soon as you stick out your chest and say, I'm the boss, they buck against you. And so the concertmaster is considered the leader of the orchestra and the person first in responsibility after the conductor. And in fact, in Great Britain, they call the concertmaster not concertmaster, but they call him the leader, him or her.
Well, the leader was, of course, in the old days, before there was a conductor, it was the first violinist.
Right.
Yes, the concertmaster of the ensemble. And he would be the one that kind of got everything going. And after all, it is ensemble playing, which means that you have to hear, you have to listen and so on. But you can't with the forces of sometimes 100 or over that, you must have a conductor. But essentially, the conductor position is relatively new in the history of music. It really is, because in the old days, they had a batteur, like in the days of Lully, when they would bang this thing. You needed someone to keep time. But then, of course, you had the leader. And even in some cases, as you say, they do, even in certain ensembles, call it the leader. But it's also technically, I mean, don't you determine a lot of how you bow? And
absolutely. My colleagues, my 104 colleagues in the orchestra, they not only watch the conductor constantly, but they watch each of their section leaders, and out of the corner of their eye, at least I hope so, they look at the concertmaster as well. And so I don't know if any of you have ever spoken with somebody who might have a bit of a speech impediment, maybe a stutterer, but you end up kind of, or somebody who does not speak English well, suddenly you stop dropping articles and suddenly you have trouble with English, or you start stuttering as well. And I think that is, in a nutshell, what happens with the concertmaster. If I decide to draw the bow very lightly across the string and not pull a deep, heavy sound out of the orchestra, suddenly you can feel the orchestra kind of let up and everybody else kind of does the same thing. They are just trained to follow the lead of the concertmaster. Now, if I pull a slow bow and a thick, chocolatey sound out, which is our hallmark in Philadelphia, you sense the same thing. And everybody kind of digs in, and you can sense the slow bow, and you can sense the sound kind of pulling out of the orchestra. So it's a big, big responsibility.
Well, do you discuss it ever with a section?
Not really. People talk so much about the great Philadelphia sound. I mean, this afternoon I've spoken to many of you who said, oh, I'm such a big fan of the Philadelphia Orchestra sound. But it's kind of like we know it's there, but we don't really talk about it. We just kind of do it. And ironically, when we talk about it the most is when we are hiring. I'm not sure if everybody is aware, but the only way you can get into the Philadelphia Orchestra is somebody moves on to a different job, which rarely happens. This is it. You can't get any higher than this. Or if somebody dies, which also happens once in a while. So very infrequently, you'll have an opening in the orchestra, and we'll have a worldwide open audition, a competition, basically. And as you narrow it down from 200 to 30 to 20 to 5 to 2, and then at that last moment, after you've sat there for 4 days of 12-hour auditions, you're deciding the fate of these two kids. We often at that time say, but is this person going to help us be a good steward of the Philadelphia Orchestra sound?
Is it the same sound as it was some years back, the string sound?
I would like to think there are vestiges of it remaining, but I think it's changed a bit, and that is because we've moved halls. Plus, it's a lot of different folks in there, but thankfully, we're not like Berlin or Europe. Some of the socialized countries, they have a mandatory retirement age. So I could be looking across the stage and see a 22-year-old kid that just graduated from Curtis, or I could see an 82-year-old man, Jerry Wiggler. Or, you know, it's great. And so that way we have this blend, like a great wine. We have many different grapes and we create this complex sound. And the older players can pass down the traditions and the slow bow and all those things that make the Philadelphia Orchestra sound. Well, the first procedure was I sent my resume in and I got a letter saying, thank you, but don't come. It's called, in the business, it's called a discouraged letter. By law, you are not allowed to reject anybody from coming to audition, but I had never been in an orchestra before. The search process for my job took a relatively long time, about 2-3 years, and I sent my resume in with no orchestral experience and, of course, a bunch of solo stuff, and they sent me the rejection letter, and I thought, okay, you know, I'm not surprised. But then I got a job. My first orchestra job was in Dallas, and so I was an associate in Dallas, and while I was there, they had a series of auditions where they would invite people to come. They would invite soloist types, or they would invite all the associate concertmasters from around the country, and so I was invited to one of those. And so I came up, and I had just auditioned for Concertmaster of Chicago for Daniel Barenboim in a private audition, and he listened to me for about 3 minutes, and obviously he wasn't thrilled because I flew to Chicago, played 3 minutes, and then that was it. So I came to Philadelphia thinking, forget it, no way. And I stayed at the DoubleTree across the street from the Academy, and I emptied the minibar until about 3 in the morning. And could somebody cover my daughter's ears, please? And then I just went and played and just absolutely had zero expectations, zero. And then suddenly they came out and they said, well, these are the numbers that advanced to the second round. And I somehow advanced to the second round. And then before I knew it, the next day I advanced to the finals, and I just couldn't believe it. And
Were they these orchestral solos like in Scheherazade and things like that?
All of them.
All of them.
It was something like 14 complete symphonies, every complete solo, about 4 different violin concertos. It was too much to prepare. Mm-hmm. It was too much. But I do consider it partly God's plan that I would get into this situation, because every single experience of my life went into those auditions each round, because I couldn't have done it without having been a strolling violinist at an Italian restaurant in New York. I couldn't have done it without helping Oscar De La Renta introduce a new fragrance at Bloomingdale's. I couldn't have done it without playing at every little bar mitzvah and birthday party in Brooklyn. I mean, really, all of those experiences, every concerto in Elkhart, Indiana, and Lakeland, Florida, all of those experiences went into those moments when Savalas said, please, you know, whatever he would ask for.
Well, I guess that's the story of life altogether. I mean, you've got to live it and you've got to go through it in order to appreciate it and to know when to take the opportunity. I mean, that's really what it's all about, certainly as an artist. But there is a very big difference between being a soloist for a career and being the concertmaster, isn't that right? I mean, to some degree. You do have your solo spots, but the whole mindset is different.
It is. I must say that being a soloist is not that hard, actually. I hate to burst everybody's bubble, but when these great soloists come through, obviously I do have immense respect for them. I feel like they are cut from a different mold than the rest of us mortals. That being said, I think it's less difficult to go around and play 90 concerts in a year, in which maybe 30 of them are a Tchaikovsky concerto, and 30 of them are a Beethoven concerto, and 20 of them are the same recital program over and over again, rather than to come in and to be a member of this orchestra and have all the eyes of your colleagues on you and the audience and everybody who just loves the tradition of the Philadelphia Orchestra and the Cleveland Orchestra and the Vienna Philharmonic. I had lunch with my predecessor, Norman Carroll, soon after I arrived, and I was having a hard time. It was very difficult. It was nerve-wracking. And I met with him in Wynwood, and we had lunch, and I said, Mr. Carroll, you were in this job for 30-something years, and I've been in this job for 9 months. When does it start to feel kind of like, I've arrived, I'm comfortable in the job, I've arrived? And he looked at me and he went, when you retire. And he made this motion with his hands like this.
with a smile on his face.
Yeah. So, you know what? He's right. And that's the way it should be. With a job like that, you should never feel like, oh, okay, let's relax. It should be scary.
Well, I think, again, anything you do, if you really do it well, there's a certain amount of anxiety before you do it. And a lot of actors say they need that little push when they go on stage to really, you know, get the feel of the role. But I think with what you're doing, you wear many hats. That's the other thing. But you also, we might add, is it an orchestra or a school?
Oh, a festival.
Yes, a festival. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I've always been quite good at organizing things, Jill. And just many years ago when my parents moved to the state of Rhode Island, I just went to visit them. And as we were driving around Narragansett, I just said, you know, Mom and Dad, I am going to, this is my stepmother, mm-hmm. I said, I'm going to start a music festival here someday and invite my friends to come up here and we're going to eat lobster and play chamber music. And I did, and that was 20 years ago. And I just stepped down as director just because I feel like my responsibilities at home with my two young children and at the orchestra are growing, and I just thought it would be the perfect time to step down. So,
and of course, you're concertizing. I mean, I know you're going around playing. You are touring as a soloist throughout, not throughout the year, but certainly part of the year.
Sure.
Isn't that true?
I do. One, probably the greatest perk of being concertmaster of the Philadelphia Orchestra is I get to play a concerto or a solo with the orchestra once a year. And I learned a long time ago that it is so different than playing a solo with any of the other orchestras that I play with. I'm going to Fairbanks, Alaska mm-hmm. in a couple of weeks, and the Long Island Philharmonic. All these orchestras are wonderful, and it's a great privilege. But when you step on the stage and play in front of the Philadelphia Orchestra, nothing is more terrifying. And I really don't exaggerate.
I was going to say, because what's happened, well, first of all, they're your peers.
So that's what makes it.
They know you as a person. You're not just an entity that appears and does this wonderful thing. But also, it's one of the greatest orchestras in the world. If you went to the Chicago Symphony, I think you also feel a little intimidated.
Absolutely. But I think I would be less intimidated with anywhere else than here in front of my colleagues. Even though I know in my heart that they want me to succeed and do well, it's just difficult. So I realized long ago that in order to prepare, I need to start preparing 2 years in advance mm-hmm. for my upcoming solo and go around and just play those pieces with other smaller orchestras and just practice the feeling of that surge of adrenaline and that nervousness.
I've always felt that fear is an amazing factor in performance. Just being afraid that you're going to fail. Mm-hmm. It's a terrible thing to say, but there is that element that makes you perfect, or at least try to perfect to the best of your ability what you're going to be doing. And there is always criticism, and there was always judgment. Certainly you have it from your peers, and you have it from the audience, and you have it from the critics. But in terms of, again, the responsibility, I wanted to make clear today, really specifically, David is got a great sense of humor, and he's relaxed, and he's accessible, and so on. But it's really something to make clear to the people that are listening to you what you're carrying around with you. I mean, this is not that you should be after this feel, oh my God, what a burden, but it is. It's a very big responsibility.
Thanks a lot, Jill.
Well, so far I've psychoanalyzed you, and I've given you something to worry about. But he is a delight and a wonderful musician, and a serious question. What about the whole future of orchestras? I mean, you're sitting in from a vantage point. What about orchestral attendance in terms of audience? What about subsidies for the orchestra? Things are tough, very, very tough in the music business, certainly. I know they're tough in the radio business, too.
Well, I do feel, I wish that our government would support the arts just a little bit more. I mean, when you look at a place like Germany, I mean, millions and millions of dollars going into the Berlin Philharmonic and the comic opera. And I just wish, because it's not just about dollars and cents. I mean, we are in the quality of life business, as you are, Jill. And, you know, given the choice, sometimes people will not necessarily make that choice to help that area of our community. And so I just feel that I wish there were a little bit more help. But that being said, I guess My feeling is, I've never said this before. I've done tons of interviews in my 10 years here, including with you, Jill. But I've never said this, but I really feel that it would be so easy to fill the hall every night. And that would be to just give the people what they want to hear.
Well, you answered my next question, because we're talking about repertoire. Absolutely. But again, isn't it kind of the role of the people in charge to educate the audience on some level? I mean, music, it moves on. The arts move on, you know.
Well, you know, somebody the other day came up to me and said, you know, when I listen to the Philadelphia Orchestra play contemporary music, it sounds like it's painful to you guys. Mm. What could I say? It's the truth. And, you know, I don't mean to say across the board. I don't want to generalize, but it's so obvious to us on stage. I walk out on that stage so many nights a year, and I just know before I even walk out. If it's Andre Watts and it's Rachmaninoff Symphony, doesn't matter who's the conductor, it's going to be full. You can't get tickets. If it's a program that was wonderful this week, Zemlinsky, unknown composers, no big soloist. It was about 60% full. I mean, granted, of course, the World Series, the parade this week and all that, but still, you can just see it. And I just, I would love to see them. I mean, we played a Beethoven symphony this week, the 7th, which everybody knows and loves. And for me, it was refreshing because I hadn't played it in so long. This is not right. These pieces should be played more because everybody wants to hear it. We want to play it. And I just disagree with this kind of taking the pressure from the critics and the academics and saying, well, you have to educate your audience. And I'm sorry. I'm going to probably get a lot of hate mail from all the composers out there and the modern music movement. But if it's good, fine. It's great. But I just feel that for the moment, we need to just give our audience what they want to hear. And
well, you know, talking about modern music, Zemlinsky is 1930, I think, okay? And we're in 2008.
Right.
So that's a contemporary composer? Not really.
Not really, no.
But no, I mean, we had trouble with Mahler before Bernstein really came out, you know, with the Mahler symphonies. But I think that what happens is, of course, that's what art is. There is an evolution that takes place. And you have to move on, and you are moving on, because society moves on, civilization moves on, and you have to reflect what's going on. So I think this is music that was, you know, this is not even contemporary music anymore. So I think that, and Richard Strauss, I mean, you know, he was also an unusual force in music at the time. But isn't that what happens? Isn't that what happens with music? Don't you have to, at some point, the orchestras have to play? Again, I think I know what you're talking about.
I agree, but I just feel that it is strange that you can go through a season brochure for the Philadelphia Orchestra and just pick a few programs that are just kind of mainstream, a Brahms symphony, and then the rest constantly unknown works, which I agree, they deserve to be heard, but I'm looking out for the orchestra, and I just feel that I want the hall to be full every night. And we are entertainers. We are not academics. We are not, oh, my gosh, I'm not going to give my address out. I'm going to get toilet papered. My trees are going to be ruined. But I really believe that nothing begets success like the appearance of success. And to see the hall packed when Andre Watts walks out and plays Rachmaninoff Concerto, what is wrong with that? That is the best.
Well, I don't think there's anything wrong, and I'm certainly not championing contemporary music, but I do certainly think that I guess there is probably the orchestra or the powers that be feel a responsibility to educating the public and bringing you new things. I think you should play tangos all the time, personally. You'll have a full house. What a delight to speak with you, David, and
thanks,
to get
Jill.
your ideas and the exuberance of your the love for what you do and the interest that you put into it and the joy that you are ultimately getting from it. And thank you so very much.
Thank you, Jill. What a privilege to speak with you.
Thank you.